from WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for joining us for our week in review of Connections. We'll start this week's episode with a question. Where did all the brilliant minds that worked in research and development at the big three, Kodak, Xerox, and Bausch & Lomb, go after those companies downsized? Many of them retired or took buyouts, but many others stayed in the area to start their own companies or join new ones in the optics and photonics industry. We talked to one of them, Julie Gerstenberger, the founder and CEO of an optics and photography company called Moondog Labs. She was a second-generation Kodaker. Here she is discussing her story and how she and her Kodak colleagues felt when they knew things were changing.
I think for many folks at Kodak, there was always an awareness of, you know, particularly for those who are close to retirement, of, you know, what might the runway look like. I felt like I had so much variety in my career and so many opportunities that wasn't really my focus. I was more interested in, you know, the opportunities and the work that we were doing until, you know, around the 2011-2012 timeframe when I just decided it was really time for me to move on and do something else.
Was it hard to see what happened to the company?
Absolutely. I'm a second generation Kodaker. I grew up bowling in the Kodak Bowling League as a child. And so, you know, for folks who grew up in Rochester, there's this different connection to Kodak as an employer and as a part of the community. So it was difficult to watch that.
So as a second generation Kodaker and as someone who maybe was gradually realizing that your entire career would not be spent there, but knowing that you didn't want to retire, did you entertain the idea that my future career might not be here in Rochester?
Oh, absolutely. My husband was also at Kodak, and when we both left, we considered moving to Michigan, where he has family. We looked at opportunities there, and, you know, when all things kind of shook out, decided that it was much more important to stay in Rochester because of the technology foundation and the opportunities to start new companies. We both work. My business partner and I founded a company. My husband works for a smaller design firm with, you know, national clients and international clients. And so you can do a lot here because of the talent that's here.
Now, you mentioned the talent. I get that. But when you mention sort of the technological base here, make that, you know, more tangible for me. Help me see what you mean by that, that would help you decide, hey, if we stay here, here's the advantage on the technology side.
Sure. So I didn't immediately upon leaving Kodak decide that the next step was to start a company. I looked at, you know, other directions to go with my career. But in optics and photonics particularly, you know, the talent and the resources, the companies, you know, the suppliers that we can work with, so much of what we need is right here, testing capability. And for Moondog Labs in particular, our first products were very focused on filmmaking. So the whole filmmaking and photography community that's here could be a great sounding board for us. I think Sujatha can, you know, probably speak a little more to the funding aspect of things. We launched our company on Kickstarter. And so, you know, really didn't go the venture capital route, which, you know, can be more of a challenge in the region. So that resource, I would say, you know, I wouldn't put Rochester in the top 10 list.
Yeah, that's good. So, and by the way, for listeners, I hope what you're hearing already is a very realistic look at this industry. You know, there's a lot of PR and there's a lot of spin, but there's also, this is a city that produced remarkable things over the decades. We can't lose sight of that. And right. Remarkable research and development here. And outstanding talent. And so the question is, you know, how is it really fitting in here? You know, did you get the sense at the time that there were a lot of your former colleagues at the big three kind of doing this, kind of trying to find a way to stay in Rochester to leverage what we still had here before people in your position either retired or moved to other cities? Was that happening often?
Oh, absolutely. Not necessarily, you know, starting companies, but people looking to stay and contribute. There are a number of colleagues who, you know, companies came and set up satellite offices in Rochester because the talent was here and it was worth their while to do that. I talked to one recruiter about a position out in Connecticut, and I wasn't interested in Connecticut. And he said, you know, what is in the water in Rochester? Because I cannot get these great optics folks to move. Some do, many do, and you know, Terry can talk about folks who were scattered across the country and are coming home for LSI, but many folks really want to stay because of the connections they have here in the community.
So I imagine that Kickstarter was sometime around, what, 2013, something
right,
like that?
Late 2013.
Late 2013. When did you know that Moondog was going to be a place you could stay for a while?
I think that, so we launched the company on Kickstarter in November, and we were approached during our Kickstarter by a filmmaker who wanted to use our product, and he shot over the Christmas break. And then we had a handful of prototypes. We sent him two. And then we didn't hear from him for many months, despite reaching out. Finally, in August, he let us know that his film was done. He was taking it to Sundance. And it was really at Sundance that we knew, because he got huge response. You know, the final credit at the premiere was, shot with Moondog Labs lenses on an iPhone 5. And the audience gasped because they didn't realize it had been shot on iPhone. And so once that was there, it really gave iPhone filmmaking that much credibility. Before, it had been kind of gimmicky. And that's when it was clear that, we had really timed things well.
Next, the remarkable story of a musician who had to make the heart-wrenching decision to leave her position as the bassist for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. This came after she lost her hearing. Galen McCormick has been speaking publicly about her journey and the challenges she faces with hearing loss. Despite more than 48 million Americans being diagnosed with the condition, there's still a lot of stigma. In this clip, Galen shares how she lost her hearing and how adaptive technology has helped her thrive.
I lost my hearing slowly in my left ear. I have Meniere's disease in both ears, but at that point it only presented on one side. And for a while I tried using a hearing aid that was a microphone. When that ear went deaf, it was a microphone on the deaf side that played into my better side, but I found it was really confusing and I ultimately wound up stopping that. And even that, even just a single-sided deafness is still kind of problematic for people, because you're looking around, you don't know who's talking, people will come up behind me, I have no idea they're there. So it was very tricky to navigate that. And added to that, I was keeping it a secret, on my job. I didn't want anyone to know because of the stigma that's carried.
And eventually it was the kind of thing that you probably couldn't deny anymore. When what happened?
When my second ear presented with the same symptoms, and it pretty quickly went downhill. There's really nowhere to hide when my whole job is correctly matching pitch with other people. So I did the best I could until the stress of it was really overwhelming. There was a particular medical event that actually caused me to completely lose the hearing in that ear for a long period, and there was really no way to get around that. And it was right around this time, actually, I met Jim. I had gone to the day of hearing, and it was at Nazareth, and I was on the faculty there, so I came over, and it was the first experience I had meeting people from HLAA. I didn't even know it existed, and I still carried that stigma inside me that hearing loss is something for older people, this association is probably for older people, but really, they're the ones that help connect me back to the community and connect me with what I could do again.
I think as we go throughout the hour, we're going to see so many relatable things for listeners and important information here. First of all, everyone can probably relate to someone in their lives, maybe stereotypically getting older, starting to lose hearing, resisting the idea of, I certainly can think of my own family member saying, I don't want to get a hearing aid, I'm not that old, or the stigma that goes with it. There's that. But there's also questions on how do you protect hearing? How do you protect hearing in children, in adults? When are we damaging our hearing? We're going to go through all of that. But when you think about Galen's position, you'd been with the RPO for how long?
Just over 20 years at that point.
And did you think there's got to be something that can be done to sort of save this position?
Oh, yeah. I tried so many things. I would play my instrument at home, see what that note is on a tuner, a little device on my music stand, and then I would sing and the note would be wrong. Or I'd try to hear things in my head before I played them. So I went through a lot of gymnastics sort of trying to figure out how I could keep this going. Could I get my colleagues to help me? And we even explored with some recording engineering staff, is there a way to use Google Glass and a microphone? And I realized I'm not really enjoying this process now. This is way too much stress.
And for someone with not only the skills you have, I'm sure a passion for music, was there a mental health impact for you?
Just oh my gosh, absolutely. I absolutely fell into depression, and it comes on very slowly, actually. I really didn't realize it. I'm glad I was working with a therapist who finally said, I really think you need to take this more seriously. I mean, I was already flipping out about what am I going to do about my job? This is what I've done since I was a teenager, really. But more than that, it was just, I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to tell people about my story. So yeah, there's a very big mental health impact.
In a strange way, I remember having a conversation after hearing your conversation with Julia with a friend who also loves classical music. And Beethoven's story actually might not do all that much service for musicians today, because Beethoven, who, I mean, documentation in around the year 1800 to his death in 1826, whatever it was, maybe isn't a perfect story, but certainly went through a great deal of hearing loss, mental anguish, but still did Ode to Joy, and Beethoven's, what, ninth in 1824 or something like that, despite all of this. And for people who might hear about these stories, they might think, well, you know, look, you can still do great things. He didn't have a cochlear implant. He didn't have technologies. How much do you think about those kind of stories and versus the reality of what you were experiencing, which was, as a bassist, I don't know if I could do this.
Right. I very much love Beethoven's story now, and I've done a lot of research about it, because believe it or not, there were some things, there were some devices, they're not digital like ours, but I found out there was something they put inside his piano to push the sound back to him. We know about the ear trumpet, which is also ridiculous. Like, if you think we're embarrassed about hearing aids, can you imagine walking around with an ear trumpet? But there were things that he tried to do until he was deaf. And the thing that I found inspiring was that he's writing this music without hearing it, because we have all that knowledge in our heads. You know, we know what our family sounds like, we know what the cat and the dog sound like. But so I actually turned my own career towards composition, and it was partly because of that. I can still hear inside, and I can still feel the instrument when I play. So there is a certain amount of enjoyment, but in terms of performing for people, it's simply not the same for me anymore.
And when you were kind of confronting the idea of losing the ability to hear, what sounds were you most scared of not hearing anymore?
Really, it's music. Honest to God, it's music. Because I thought, I'll always know what the instruments sound like, but I won't know anything new now. I would be curious for you to talk about this, Don. Like, when we listen to music, we know our brain kind of fills it in and makes it sound right. But when I go stop by the RPO and they're rehearsing, if they're playing something I don't know, it is utter gibberish to me. So I was really afraid. It's a real clinging to, like, what you know you're going to lose, even though you don't know what that is. I don't know what music is going to be written. But I think the way our brains work is fascinating. So I know what my daughter's voice is supposed to sound like. And now that I have these devices, it's not perfect, but my brain kind of rounds it up to write.
We'll end the week with some music. The CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival kicks off this weekend, and this year's fest will see more than 1,500 artists throughout its 9 days. One of those artists is award-winning vocalist Catherine Russell. She returns to Rochester for her 7th Jazz Fest appearance. She says she keeps coming back to town because she loves the vibe of the Rochester Festival and how inclusive it is for all audiences. We had a chance to talk with her and hear some of her music. In this clip, you'll hear her song, You Can't Pull the Wool Over My Eyes, followed by Catherine talking about her career.
You can't pull the wool over my eyes.
You know, Catherine, whenever I get the chance to talk to somebody with this level of talent in a voice, I love to ask, you know, when you knew that that was inside you. But you're a little bit different of the people I've interviewed, because you grew up with this frankly sterling musical pedigree. Your dad served as Louis Armstrong's musical director. Your mom was a member of International Sweethearts of Rhythm. You probably knew very early that this was in you, I would suspect.
Well, the thing I knew was that I had an ear for music, but I didn't really, and I was actually a dancer first before I ever went into music, but I did know that I could harmonize, you know, so I said, oh, okay, I can, I used to harmonize to the, you know, Star Spangled Banner, or, you know, whatever when we sing that in school, you know, I was always harmonizing to that. And, but performing is a whole different skill, you know, so that took me a little longer to get comfortable with, because I wasn't, you know, naturally comfortable being the center of attention. So the skill of the musical part and then the craft of performance are two entirely different things, you know. So I've learned over the years from colleagues, from, you know, I've had a lot of help, you know, I've had a lot of great support in the music community, you know, with gaining confidence in different ways, you know. So it's a very interesting road, you know, but I really enjoy now headlining, being my own band leader, because I get to play in different places. I get to meet different people. I would never done Rochester Festival had I not done it, you know, as a band leader. So these are the type of things that, you know, presents, gifts that you get in life, you know, with decisions, you know, that weren't necessarily that I didn't really plan, you know, in the beginning. So I'm grateful.
We're talking to Catherine Russell, the remarkable Catherine Russell, who will be back in Rochester for the seventh time for the Jazz Festival, the CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival, which opens tomorrow, rochesterjazz.com. Catherine has a reputation as a phenomenal live performer, and that's an interesting distinction for me, Catherine, because sometimes you hear someone who is amazing in the studio, and live they're good, but you know, in the studio they're sort of a different thing. And then there's someone like you who seems to be able to just turn it on wherever you go. So let me kind of give you a hard one here, but who's the best live singer you ever played with?
That I've ever worked with?
Yep.
That is a tough question. Well, I would start with David Bowie. I would say that, you know, he was an iconic singer performer, and he just really made, for me, he made any venue intimate, because we did from stadiums to little clubs to all sizes, different theaters, all different sizes of venues, and he made everything intimate for me. And second, I would say, would be Cyndi Lauper, because she's a very dynamic performer, and you know, these people just get out there and they give 200% every show, you know, which is how I, you know, learned. I said, oh no, you have to go out there. You can't leave anything. You know, you got to leave everything on the stage. You know, you just got to go out there and just give it like it's your last, you know, day on earth or whatever. So this is what I have, what I strive to do. And also I need the audience. You know, I love, people have a lot of choices in life. They don't have to come to my show. So I'm very happy that they choose to come to our show, you know, so for that reason, you know, they're my guests. I have to take care of them. So that's what I've learned, you know, from the people that I work for.
That's great stories. Catherine Russell, and you talk to people in the musical industry and people who teach music, and certainly they see the CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival, and it thrives. But at the same time, it's, you know, jazz has had to fight for its share in the musical world and sort of not try to lose ground over the years. I wonder how you feel about sort of what makes for modern pop success and how you feel about where music has gone in terms of what sells these days and jazz's place in there.
You know, there's always been, I believe, the pop element to, you know, what's going to cross over, what's not going to ruffle people's nerves, what's going to be easy to listen, what's not going to offend, what's not going to do this and that. So there, you know, there's one element which is kind of the easy listening crossover thing, which, you know, are on the bigger radio stations and what have you, you know, not college stations and not smaller stations. And then there is the what are the kids listening to element, you know, what's going to sell to the kids. So I don't know if we can control that, but what the elders and the big people in jazz these days who are driving, you know, Wynton Marsalis, Christian McBride, these people who are really getting multi-generational jazz happening. So we're involving young people, we're involving kids, we're raising them up in this music and showing them how it's really a community music. And that's the way it thrives, you know, and that's the way, one person at a time, that's the way we get things onto the radio and get things exposed, you know, and so that people aren't afraid of the word jazz. You know, they hear jazz and they think, ooh, you know, I can't understand it or I can't. So we have to show them that, you know, it is accessible to everyone.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. Hey, it's the first day of summer, everybody, on this Friday, so get out there, enjoy the weather, maybe see you at the Jazz Fest. I'm here by myself, so maybe that's where Evan is. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.